This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, and thanks for tuning in to Trumpet Hour today. I'm Joel Hilliker. What happens when the Queen of England dies? Queen Elizabeth is 95 years old. Recently, she's had some health issues that have kept her out of some public engagements. She's been holding meetings via Zoom rather than in person. She's been speaking to the Prime Minister over the phone rather than holding their regular weekly face-to-face meetings. So a lot of people are concerned about the Queen's health. The Trumpet editor-in-chief has written a lot about this woman and about the British throne, and he's planning a short article for the coming print edition of the Trumpet on this subject. The Queen represents an era in British history that is virtually gone. We'll talk about this in our first segment and follow up about it in our last word for today's show. But we have plenty more coming this hour. In our second segment, we'll talk about Joe Biden's plans to spend some $65 billion on government-owned internet networks. They want more people to have internet access, but what happens when the government has control over that kind of technology? We'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about this. Then we'll look at France, where President Emmanuel Macron is facing a stiff challenge from the political right. There's a lot of concern in that country over immigration and the loss of cultural identity. And a new mainstream right politician is garnering a lot of popular support by speaking to these issues. This is a prophetically significant trend in this pillar European nation. We'll hear a report about it from Trumpet writer Josue Michels. We'll also hear about civil war simmering in Lebanon. In our October 15th week in review, we informed you about clashes taking place between Hezbollah and Christian Lebanese forces. We'll get more details about this from Trumpet writer Mihailo Zekic. So, Elizabeth II has been queen for 69 years, 270 days. This coming February 6th, it will be 70 years since she became Britain's monarch. February 6th, 1952 was when her father, King George VI, died. America's president at that time was Harry Truman. We've had 14 different men as president while this woman has been on the British throne. She's the longest reigning ruler in the world. She's the longest reigning monarch in British history. She's been a remarkable example of class and of duty and of service to her people. But she is not immortal. She's 95 years old. She's had a few health problems lately. British journalist Melanie Phillips wrote this: "The Queen is an irreplaceable constant in the life of the British nation. Her public appearances aren't just the exercise of her role as the symbol of the nation, as so many feel so viscerally, she is the nation. With her unrivaled sense of duty, her stoicism, and her emotional restraint, many see in the Queen the embodiment of a Briton whose cultural identity is inexorably fraying. Many feel in their bones that when the Queen eventually passes, Britain will just not be the same. Despite the fact that the monarchy will continue, something of infinite value will have been lost." Now, this might be something a lot of us can identify with, even if we're not British. Things are really rapidly changing in the world today. And what we're witnessing is the end of the long period of Anglo-American dominance in the world and the beginning of a new period, which we'll talk about in a moment. A lot has changed since Queen Elizabeth assumed the throne. Britain is totally different than it was in 1952. Our editor-in-chief wrote an article in our September 2017 issue, The Fall of the British Royal Family, and he talked about this point specifically. He wrote, "In 1952, when Elizabeth took the throne, the British Empire was beginning its descent from world power." Really, at that time, it was near the height of its power. Certainly, it was in the years leading up to World War II. But he wrote, she has witnessed it shrink from empire to commonwealth to a less and less relevant second-rate power. And he said back in 2016, the BBC produced a beautiful brochure celebrating Queen Elizabeth's 90th birthday, Queen Elizabeth 90 glorious years. In commenting on the death of King George VI, the BBC editors wrote, Britain 64 years ago was a country almost unimaginably different in outlook, attitudes, morals, and ethos than today, to say nothing of technology. Opinion polls into the early 1960s showed that as many as a third of respondents believed that the Queen had been chosen by God rather than by right of succession from her father. Now, that thinking was very common in Britain at one time, and it is very much in a small, tiny minority today. But the royal biographer Penny Dreurer told Town and Country that Queen Elizabeth's death would be traumatic for Britain. She wrote, the Queen is such a tremendously popular figure, and during the course of her reign, so much has changed so dramatically. There's not an aspect of life that hasn't changed, but the one constant in the midst of all this has been the Queen, the rock-solid thing we can hang on to. As soon as Queen Elizabeth dies, Prince Charles will become king. He can choose his own name. He's expected to choose the name King Charles III. And what happens then? According to YouGov polling, the Queen has the highest favorability ratings of any member of the royal family, 72%. And that is followed by her husband, who died last spring. Prince Charles has a 45% favorability rating, and his wife a 33% rating. And among millennials, among younger people in Britain, Charles' favorability is 33%. His wife's is 25%. So it does raise the question, what sort of role will the royal family play in Britain's future and in the nations of the Commonwealth? The Queen is recognized as head of state in 15 countries outside the UK, out of 54 countries that are part of the British Commonwealth. There are already strong movements in Canada and Australia to make a break from the British crown. Scotland is trying to leave the UK. Barbados just renounced the monarchy. Jamaica could be next. Back in 2016, the country's parliament considered a constitutional amendment to renounce the Queen. This is from an article in Forbes last September. Australians voted to keep the Queen in a 1999 referendum, but more recent polling shows that replacing the Queen with an Australian head of state may now have majority support. A MarchResearch.co survey in Canada found that 32% of Canadians would prefer an elected head of state, while only 27% prefer to keep the monarchy. So you have to wonder how much a transition to King Charles would accelerate this trend. Would he even take over as the ceremonial head of the British Commonwealth? He wouldn't do so automatically. That would have to be determined at the time. A Canadian news organization, iPolitics, says the current mood among Commonwealth leaders is to look beyond Charles to a time when the head of the Commonwealth is rotated by election or selection among representatives of the member states. It's likely the Queen's death would hasten some major political changes for nations that have been closely connected with Britain, weakening and dissolving the already fading ties that once formed the greatest empire this world has ever seen, the British Empire. Believe it or not, that empire was specifically prophesied in the Bible. It was a fulfillment of a promise God made to the patriarch Abraham in Genesis 35 and verse 11. He said, a nation and a company of nations shall be of you, and kings shall come out of your loins. And as Herbert W. Armstrong proved in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that company of nations was the British Empire, which was later reduced to the British Commonwealth. it's easy to forget just how great Britain was and how recently, at the turn of the last century, its wealth and power were immense. It was the world's number one or number two producer of petroleum, coal, steel, pig iron, gold, and nearly every other precious metal. Its electricity output dwarfed every other nation. Its Royal Navy, by law, larger than the world's next two largest navies combined, extended the empire's presence around the world. The Company of Nations over which it ruled comprised one out of every four people on Earth and one out of every 5 acres on the planet. But the same God who prophesied of that empire and brought it to pass also warned that it would collapse if it turned away from him. And that is what it has done. And that collapse has come just as surely. It has occurred over the decades since Queen Elizabeth has been on that throne. But it's going to continue and will almost surely accelerate under her successor. The Bible foretells the dramatic fall of Britain and of America in this end time, and says that it'll be followed by an extremely dark and violent period. And we're already seeing that building in the world today. The British monarchy has been a constant in British life for over 1,000 years. Now, believe it or not, God also had a direct hand in that. In 2 Samuel 7, verses 12 to 16, God promised to establish the throne of David of ancient Israel forever. He said there would be an unending dynasty of royal descendants on that throne. And other prophecies show that it will eventually be handed over to Jesus Christ himself. When Christ becomes King of Kings, he will be sitting on the throne of David. You can read that in Isaiah 9 and verse 7 and Luke 1 and verse 32. And you can follow the history from King David, and Herbert Armstrong describes it in the United States and Britain in Prophecy, how God preserved that throne in the kingdom of Judah. Then he moved it to Ireland through the prophet Jeremiah in 569 BC, and then it was overturned two more times, first to Scotland in AD 513 and then to England in 1296. And you can follow that royal line through the movements of Jacob's Pillar Stone. That's the stone over which British monarchs have been crowned since Edward I captured it from Scotland and moved it to Westminster Abbey in 1296 AD. When you look back at Elizabeth's coronation in 1953, you see all kinds of evidence of this biblical history. Giles Fraser has an article in Unheard just in about a week ago, and he looks back at Elizabeth's coronation, and he wrote this, speaking of the central moment of the whole ceremony: "Then the queen was disrobed of her crimson cloak and her jewelry removed. Here she sat in simple white dress on a wooden throne to be anointed by the Archbishop of Canterbury with holy oil, a mixture of ambergris, civet, orange flowers, roses, jasmine, cinnamon, musk, and benzoin, ladled from a 12th century spoon. This is when the choir sings Zadok the Priest, its words extracted from the first book of Kings, sung at every English coronation since 973 AD. These echoes of the Hebrew Bible are deliberate. She, like Solomon, was dedicated to God. Kings and queens are supposed to be servants too. In Christian terms, like the servant king who emptied himself of power in order to achieve his most important work." Fraser writes, "Monarchy is a religious business, or else it would be nothing more than a technical constitutional necessity that sits at the intersection of money and class and power. And the essence of this religious business, the unseen holiness, as it were, is a kind of vulnerability that places one's life in the service of other people and of God. This is why all these headlines we're now seeing about the Queen being, quote, tired and exhausted, reflect something of the heart of her ministry, for that is what her role remains." It's quite an insightful bit of analysis from a man in this world, and he really does get to the heart of what Queen Elizabeth's rule has been about. When she was coronated, when she was crowned, the priests presented her with a Bible, and they called it the most valuable gift this world affords. They read Deuteronomy 17, verses 18 to 19. Those are God's laws to the kings of Israel. And the archbishop said, these are the lively oracles of God. And really, the queen has been pretty faithful to that calling that she agreed to at her coronation. But this is entirely lost to the remaining members of the royal family. And this is really a great deal of what will be lost when the queen dies. And it already has been lost in Britain today. In that Trumpet article, Mr. Fleury wrote, Britain no longer has such respect for the Bible or for God. There is an indisputable connection between Britain losing its belief in God and his connection to the monarchy, and the massive changes for the worse in Britain's outlook, attitudes, morals, and ethos. Britain has lost its faith in God and King and lost its moral moorings at the same time. Prince Charles said in 1999 that if he were to become king, he would want to assume the official title not as defender of the faith, that's what generations of monarchs have called themselves. He wants to be the defender of faith, protecting all faiths in Britain. And Mr. Fleury wrote, this sounds righteous to a lot of people today. Modern society has virtually swallowed whole the lie that diversity is our strength. But just look at the disastrous results of such thinking. It has left Britain faithless, materialistic, divided, and vulnerable to foreign extremists. The Church of England has lost its moral authority, loosening its standards on all the hot-button issues of the day, women in the clergy, premarital sex, homosexuality. The monarchy, rather than working to prevent the moral slide and uphold godly standards, has just watched it happen and even gone along with it. British society has suffered immeasurably as a result. And these are the trends we can expect to intensify when Queen Elizabeth dies. But God has a plan for correcting the problem, and he's already put it in place. And we'll talk about that in the last word for today's show. Stick around for that.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The Biden administration wants to make internet available for far more Americans. What happens when the government controls technology like this? We'll find out in this report from Andrew Miller.
The radical left wants to nationalize the internet like the Soviets did utilities. The United States Senate approved on August 10th a $1.2 trillion package to modernize America's aging infrastructure. The bill must now pass the House of Representatives, where House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says Democrats will not vote on it until the Senate passes an even more ambitious $3.5 trillion social policy bill. But if passed into law, both bills would worsen America's economic crisis by increasing the federal debt and fueling inflation. It is important that Americans understand what they're getting for their money. Only $110 billion of the $1.2 trillion infrastructure package is going towards roads, bridges, and similar products. Much of the rest has been earmarked for zero-emission school buses, electric car charging stations, and government-owned internet networks. Under the guise of closing the digital divide between rich and poor, the $1.2 trillion bill allocates about $65 billion to expand broadband across the country. Some of this spending funds things like $50 a monthly credits for low-income Americans to pay for internet access, but $42 billion is to create government-owned networks, which advocates say are needed in low-income areas. Now, many analysts feel this spending is a waste of money given government broadband's history of corruption and failure. Actually, a coalition of pro-market think tanks warned Congress in a letter that, with few exceptions, government-owned networks have been abject failures. For example, Kentucky Wired is a 3,000-mile government-owned network that was sold to taxpayers as a $350 million project that would be completed by the spring of 2016. Those projections could not have been more wrong. More than 5 years past the supposed completion date, fiber construction for Kentucky Wired is still in progress in some parts of the state, and a report from the state auditor has concluded that the taxpayer will end up wasting a whopping $1.5 billion on this redundant government-owned network over its 30-year life. Now, Michael Powell, the CEO of Internet and Television Association, criticized the bill, saying, "The idea that the private sector and the profit incentive are intrinsically unsuited to do the job is surprisingly Soviet." As president, Barack Obama steamrolled the laws of 19 states to clear the way for federal spending on government broadband with a 2009 stimulus bill that earmarked $7 billion for government-owned internet networks. Now, the Biden administration is following in his footsteps by earmarking even more for government broadband. It would certainly be far more cost-effective to let the free market spread internet networks to areas of the country where people are able to pay the price for internet access. But the Biden administration ultimately wants to nationalize the internet in a similar manner to how the Soviets nationalized public utilities. The late Trumpet contributor Ron Fraser highlighted an executive order signed by President Obama in 2012 that gave the White House unprecedented control to interfere with the private communications of United States citizens. This executive order, titled Assignment of National Security and Emergency Preparedness Communications Functions, granted new powers to the Department of Homeland Security, including the ability to collect public communications information and seize private facilities, effectively shutting down civilian communications in the event of a national emergency. Mr. Fraser wrote in his article, "Obama's Sweeping New Powers," "The threat this executive order poses to any legitimate organization that speaks out against or otherwise resists government action incompatible with the intent of the U.S. Constitution, which certain radicals both within and aiding this current U.S. administration's radical agenda have stated is outdated, is glaringly obvious." Consider the gospel message in this context. Your Bible declares that a time will come when the land is not able to bear the words of a prophet. The result will be that certain powers will shut down the broadcasting and prevent the publishing of the true gospel message. And then that article cites Amos 7 verses 10 and Amos 8 verses 11 through 12 as the scriptures about this famine of the word coming. Now, the radical left has been working with the big tech oligarchs for years to censor the internet. Now the Biden administration is actually trying to nationalize and control the networks needed to bring internet access to people's homes. At this pace, it won't be long before the U.S. government actually has the power to ban God's truth from being spread throughout the nation. For more information on what the Bible says about a soon coming time of intense censorship, please read the chapter titled The Famine of the Word in our free booklet, The Lion Has Roared, by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury.
Thank you very much, Andrew. There are a few concerning things about what the government is trying to do here. And as you pointed out from that one watchdog organization, the government's attempts to build infrastructure, communication infrastructure along these lines is pretty poor. They just don't do things nearly as efficiently as the private sector does. That's a problem in and of itself. But there's a more sinister problem that you're talking about. That is the government actually trying to control communications within the United States. And there's quite a bit of evidence to show they're already doing that in many ways. A lot of that is through very close cooperation with the big tech corporations and communication giants in the country already.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, this story, when I was browsing through news lines looking for something to write about, really jumped out at me just because of how like overt and in your face the fact that the U.S. government actually nationalizing an internet network and running it itself is. But like I said, that being said, the government does do maybe less overt things all the time that gives it almost just as much control over internet networks. Usually they don't come out like they did in this case and just overtly build it and run it themselves. Usually they work with an organization like Google, which was established with grants from the CIA in order to like help them build better algorithms than the competition in return for the expected quid pro quo that Google would be working with the CIA and the national security state. Like I said, Google was founded. It makes its money by tracking your search history and then sending you advertisements that you'd be interested in. But it also has, in the process of doing that with those algorithms, it gains a tremendous amount of information on like a personal profile on each citizen, what they like, what they do with this stuff like that, that in certain circumstances, the government may find useful. And more recently, we're even seeing not just like spying concerns, but like censorship concerns to where they're censoring stories critical of Joe Biden, censoring stories critical of the government, and almost working like an American version of Pravda, like this Soviet state-owned network. Mm. But it's not as in your face as like not having a national news network, because it's still a private company that's working with the government and, mm-hmm. and taking orders from the government, but not necessarily being owned by it. But you're already starting to see like certain information being shadow banned or censored that could really get much, much worse in the time ahead as the government now starts moving into owning some of these networks that Google's using as well.
You could almost think of some of these tech giants as like success stories of the free market. You have, you know, somebody who starts a company in his garage and then it grows to be this massive this massive corporation with such influence in the country, thanks to just the markets that are available and the opportunities that the free market makes available. In truth, government funding and government favoritism have allowed these companies to get the kind of influence in American life that they've come to get. That's played a huge role in it. And you look at, say, within the Soviet system, where there was so much that was accomplished by central planners, in a command economy, it's actually a bit of a wrinkle that communist sympathizing politicians within the United States have employed here by essentially co-opting and joining forces with some of these companies that maybe have more free market roots. But now they're, like you said, they're accomplishing very similar functions to what you would see in a Soviet, a flat-out communist system.
Yeah, it is a kind of a weird irony, because, I mean, you see even in America today, some of the, like, the far-left movements, you've got, like, the Occupy Wall Street sitting there talking about how Wall Street's taking over and these big companies are taking over, so, and they're in bed with the government, so we need the government to step up and regulate them, which seems like a weird solution if the original problem was collusion between companies and the government to begin with. But you almost kind of end up in the in the same place. It's like two roads to collectivism, that like you can have a Bolshevik styles people's revolution where you just overthrow all the big companies and then nationalize it in the hands of the proletariat, like Karl Marx talked about, or you can just have the big companies get so big that they own everything, like monopoly. Mm-hmm. But either way, there's a central planning committee at the end of the tunnel.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating to see all of the ways that the government has managed to get a grip on the economy of this country. We talked last week about just the wealth transfer from the middle class into the hands of these oligarchs, kind of the modern day oligarchs, the tech giants and so on, and the wealthiest billionaires who've seen an enormous amount of increase in their wealth over the COVID pandemic, for example. They've really managed to kind of find ways to implement communism through the back door in America. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about plans for government-owned internet. Andrew wrote an article about this. Joe Biden plans to spend billions on government-owned internet networks. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
France is shifting to the right politically, a trend that can be seen in the growing popularity of a politician who is challenging the nation's president, as we will hear in this report from Josue Michels.
French philosopher Eric Zemmour is polarizing France with his anti-Islam, right-wing rhetoric, and is believed to have a good chance of winning the next presidential election. That's if he chooses to run. Zemmour is a famous television personality and book author. He is rallying millions behind his ideas. A recent poll put him at 17% popularity. That's ahead of Marine Le Pen, of the far-right National Rally, and just behind President Emmanuel Macron. Though Zemmour has not announced to run for the presidency, T-shirts that read Zemmour 2022 are already being sold, and chants such as Zemmour Presidor can be heard on his book promotion tour. The Spectator noted, quote, "He has a devoted and surprisingly professional campaign behind him, the nucleus of a political party conceived with a clear mission to restore la gloire de la France. His new book has the faintly ridiculous title La France n'a pas dit son dernier mot, France has not said its final word, and has already sold more than 150,000 copies. He's insanely popular," end of quote. Popularity, of course, is a key to win a fair election. But what makes Zemmour's rise interesting is why he draws so much support. In France's last election, Le Pen attempted a more moderate campaign in an effort to beat Macron. Zemmour is going the other direction, using patriotic, anti-Islam rhetoric with incredible success. As an author and TV host, Zemmour gives the impression of being educated and mainstream. He often speaks directly to the French people. On CN News, France's second most watched news network, his 63 years of age add to his credibility, as does his eloquence and knowledge. What's more, his racial background provides him near immunity from criticism. The Spectator wrote, "Bernard-Henri Levy, another flamboyant public intello, has accused him of being a Jewish anti-Semite. The truth is, Zemmour, the son of Algerian immigrants, says lots of things Levy has said about Islam over the years, just more forcefully. He also says what a lot of French people know to be right. France has failed to assimilate large parts of its Muslim population, and that is a problem." End of quote. Many in France realize that a nation's large Muslim population and corresponding terrorist threat provide a challenge France simply cannot handle. Zemmour advocates some of the same solutions as Charles de Gaulle: national independence, social policy, and the idea of a Christian France. Zemmour's defense of a Christian Europe is rooted in French tradition, but he has his issues with the current Pope. In 2020, Zemmour accused Pope Francis of siding with the enemies of Europe. He said, quote, "We had two great popes, John Paul II and Pope Benedict XVI. One was Polish, the other German, deeply European, deeply rooted in their national identities, who believed in nations, who believed in European nations in particular. So here we have a guy who comes from South America, who despises Europe, who obviously, as far as I know, hates France. In particular, he despises Europe and then delivers a universalist discourse like a non-government organization," end of quote. Francis, he claimed, is a post-Catholic pope, and Catholics aren't obliged to obey him. This isn't the only polarizing topic Zemmour speaks out on. Macron is known for spearheading anti-American rhetoric in the European Union. Zemmour likes to take it a step further. Near the beaches of the 1944 D-Day landing, where soldiers shed their blood to defeat Nazism, he said, quote, "The landing was at once a liberation of the national territory, at the same time an occupation and colonization by the Americans," end of quote. His view on France's Nazi collaborators also differs from the historically established reality. Zemmour said in a CN News segment that French collaborators did the best they could to protect French Jewish lives by only giving up foreign Jews to the Nazi regime. As the New York Times wrote, this is just, quote, "one of several remarks suggesting that the wartime government of Marshal Philippe Pétain that sent more than 72,500 Jews to their death was not so bad after all," end of quote. With this mixture of anti-American, anti-immigration, and pro-Nazi collaborators' rhetoric, Zemmour stands in opposition to Macron. Regardless of whether Zemmour runs for president, it is significant that millions in France are willing to vote for far-right leaders like Le Pen and Zemmour. France as a whole is shifting to the right. The Spectator concluded, quote, "Zemmour's route. He spies an opportunity to offer a new third way for the right. He can mix populist rhetoric about immigration and Macron's ghastly vaccine passports with detailed plans for healthcare reform and a new corporate tax system. He remains a wild insurgent and a very long shot for the presidency. He may just end up being another vote splitter on the right. His campaign could have problems financing itself," end of quote. France has a strong appetite for radical politics that doesn't shy away from confronting the liberal trends sweeping through Europe. Macron will either need to shift even further to the right or lose his presidency. Either way, French politics will become more right-wing. France wants a leader that preserves France's culture and identity. In April, French retired generals urged Macron to act against Islam and threatened military coup if no action followed. The letter was signed by 20 former generals and more than 1,500 members of the military, police, and gendarmerie. It called on France's leaders to safeguard the nation from Islamic threats and to preserve France's history. Many fear that the days of Christian Europe are numbered and that the continent will succumb to Islam. But if you look at history, it's apparent that this common trend may have a completely different outcome. There's reason why those on the far right talk about Muslim invasions. They happened in Europe's history. One of the most famous examples came in the 8th century when Charles Martel, Charlemagne's grandfather, led Europeans to defeat an Islamic invasion. Historian Edward Gibbon portrayed Martel as the savior of Christian Europe, writing that without him, quote, "the interpretation of the Quran would not be taught in the schools of Oxford," end of quote. For those who fear a Muslim takeover today, the solution may be another Charles Martel. And indeed, the Bible reveals that a violent conflict is looming. Revelation 17 prophesies that the Holy Roman Empire will rise one more time. Daniel 11 calls this empire the King of the North. In verse 40 we read, "And at the time of the end shall the King of the South push at him, and the King of the North shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen, and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries, and shall overflow and pass over." As trumpet editor-in-chief Jeff Louis explains in The King of the South, "This prophecy is yet to be fulfilled. It describes a confrontation between the King of the North, a German-led European empire, and the King of the South, which Mr. Louis identified as radical Islam, led by Iran. Based on these and other Bible prophecies, Mr. Louis has warned that a clash is about to erupt. This prophecy describes a time when Germany's Catholic Empire will wage all-out war, throwing everything it has at radical Islam and dominating it like a violent flood pouring in," Mr. Fleury explained. "Just a few years ago, this would have seemed unthinkable, but more and more in Europe are willing to fight to preserve the continent's culture."
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Recent unrest in Lebanon points to the prospect of civil war seizing this nation, as we will now hear in this report from Mihailo Zekic.
The Middle East is one of the most turbulent regions in the world. But some parts of the Middle East are more turbulent than others. Lebanon is one of those areas. The country was stuck in a civil war from 1975 to 1990. The war was fought primarily between the Lebanese government and militias controlled by Christians and Shia Muslims. While the war ended over 3 decades ago, the conflict is, in many ways, still unresolved. Many of the groups involved are still influential in modern Lebanon, and some of those old issues are beginning to resurface. On October 14th, armed sects clashed with each other in Beirut, killing 7 and injuring over 32. The city's Tayuneh neighborhood saw gunfire between 2 Shiite groups, Hezbollah and the Amal movement, and a Christian group called the Lebanese Forces. According to eyewitnesses, the conflict started when several young men came to the neighborhood chanting Shiite slogans. They started talking to other young men from the area, and then a fistfight broke out. One of the local youths pulled out a Kalashnikov rifle, while the Shiite protesters got weapons, including RPGs, or rocket-propelled grenades, from their vehicles. Hezbollah also alleges that, during the clashes, the Lebanese forces were using snipers. The Lebanese forces deny this. 4 hours after the start of hostilities, the Lebanese army came to de-escalate the situation. The day after the shooting, Lebanon observed a day of mourning, with schools and businesses closing. The 2 Shiite groups were originally protesting the selection of a judge, Tariq Bitar, who was investigating the origins of the Port of Beirut explosion of ammonium nitrate that killed over 200 in August of last year. Many Hezbollah supporters, including Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah, called the investigations of Judge Bitar politically motivated. Given Hezbollah's control of the port and past use of ammonium nitrate in terrorist attacks, Hezbollah is most likely trying to cover its tracks of any association or involvement with the port explosion. Earlier in the week of the clash, Bitar issued an arrest warrant for Ali Hassan Khalil, a former finance minister and Hezbollah associate. The location for the clashes couldn't have been more symbolic. During the civil war, Beirut was divided into zones controlled by competing warlords. Christian and Muslim militias tussled in the streets for control. Tayune was one of the worst-hit neighborhoods. Many worry, then, that this latest clash is a harbinger of things to come. Many are afraid civil war could come again. It is not acceptable for arms to return as a language of communication between the Lebanese parties because we all agreed to turn this dark page from our history, said Lebanese Prime Minister Michel Aoun in a speech. Aoun called the violence painful and unacceptable. Hezbollah supporters, including state media from Iran, who sponsors Hezbollah, blame Samir Jaja, leader of the Lebanese forces, for what happened. According to the Jerusalem Post, a pro-Hezbollah medium claimed that militants from the Lebanese forces led by Samir Jaja were the main perpetrators of the attack. Iran's Fars news agency referred to the plan of Samir Jaja, the leader of the Lebanese forces, with the so-called American-sponsored Al-Qaeda to counter Hezbollah's protests. Nasrallah called the clash a new stage for Hezbollah. Hezbollah has warned Jaja that 100,000 Hezbollah fighters now oppose him. Nasrallah said, "The biggest threat to the existence of Christians and the security of the Christian community in Lebanon is the Lebanese forces." Lebanon has for years now teetered on the verge of political instability. But while other Arab states, like Iraq, Syria, and Yemen, have fallen into civil war, Lebanon has so far been spared. Beirut has been able to keep its head above the water, barely. The latest clashes could be a sign that this is going to change, and soon. On August 4th, 2020, the world was shocked by a massive explosion that destroyed much of downtown Beirut, the capital of Lebanon, wrote Trumpet editor-in-chief Gero Fleury in his article, Why We Told You to Watch Lebanon. Mr. Fleury continued, "It quickly became clear that this blast will likely ignite a radical political change within the nation." Fast forward a year later, and the Beirut blast's fallout is still having a tremendous effect on Lebanese society. Hezbollah currently exerts an enormous amount of influence in Lebanon. The militant Shiite group is a proxy of Iran and an enemy of the West. But the Beirut blast and Hezbollah's implication in the incident is alienating the group from many Lebanese. Nasrallah has led Hezbollah since 1992. Jaja has led the Lebanese forces since 1986, during the Lebanese Civil War. Both men have been around for a long time. Both men have seen a lot. Perhaps they have old scores to settle. About two-thirds of Lebanese are Muslim, split about evenly between Sunnis and Shiites. Roughly a third are Christian, most of them Catholic. Other religious minorities in Lebanon include Orthodox Christians and members of the Druze religion. Lebanon's religious medley makes it particularly volatile in the chaotic Middle East. Will Lebanon descend into civil war again? And if a civil war did break out, what would it mean for Lebanon in the long term? Taking into consideration the nation's large Christian population, relatively unique among the Arab states, a civil war could turn into a religious war like what happened in the former Yugoslavia, when Muslims, Catholics, and Orthodox Christians butchered each other for control. This could then turn Lebanon into a humanitarian catastrophe. Also, one should consider the recent civil wars in Syria and Iraq. Between the bloodshed, the rise of terrorism, and the exodus of refugees, the civil wars forced outside players, players like America, Europe, Iran, Russia, Turkey, to get involved. In Lebanon's case, Europe would be one of the main players to watch for. The Syrian refugee crisis impacted Europe heavily. Even though Lebanon has a smaller population than Syria, any threat to its Catholic population especially would catch Europe's eye. And it is also worth mentioning that after last year's blast, French President Emmanuel Macron made a high-profile visit to Beirut in a show of solidarity with the Lebanese people. His presence was so welcomed by the Lebanese that many wanted Macron to make Lebanon a French colony again. Finally, if public anger against Hezbollah was to boil over, a civil war could finally force Hezbollah and, by extension, Iran, out of Lebanon. Mr. Fleury said in a 2014 episode of his Key of David television program the following, "That means there's going to be now a civil war, a bloody civil war in Lebanon for control of Lebanon, and you're going to see Lebanon and the European power prevail in that battle." This is why we told you to watch Lebanon, and the latest clash is a sign that this prediction is about to be fulfilled. To learn more, please read our articles, Why We Told You to Watch Lebanon, by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury, and The Beirut Blast, Catalyst for Biblical Prophecy, by our Jerusalem correspondent Brent Noctegal. You can find both at thetrumpet.com.
It's time for today's Last Word.
Regarding the royal family of Britain, there is an important end time prophecy in Hosea 3 and verse 4. And this is talking about the Great Tribulation. That's a time of terrible suffering that precedes Christ's return. And it says this, "For the children of Israel shall abide many days without a king and without a prince, and without a sacrifice, and without an image." And that word is speaking of Jacob's pillar stone. In his booklet, The Key of David, Gerald Fleury wrote this. This is describing a very tragic period, the Great Tribulation, almost upon us. It is a prophecy about Ephraim, Britain, Manasseh, the United States, and Judah, the Jewish state of Israel, when they no longer have a king or even a prince. Jeremiah wrote in Jeremiah 33:17 that David's throne would never lack a man sitting on it. Yet here it says that for a time Israel will have no king or prince. How can you reconcile this apparent contradiction? The contradiction that God's promise to David was he would never lack an heir to that throne, and that has been fulfilled all these centuries, even millennia. But right at the end, there's going to come a point when that king and that stone will not be there. And this is what awaits Britain in the time just ahead. Many other prophecies show that that nation will be conquered. The people of Britain will be taken into captivity. Our editor-in-chief has written about these prophecies in the book, The New Throne of David. This is a free book that you can have for your own if you just ask for it. But he writes in that booklet, "By the time this prophecy is fulfilled, Britain will have been conquered by the Holy Roman Empire. The British lose their king, and they lose their stone, a symbol of David's throne. What does that mean? God promised to continue that throne forever, yet here we see that suddenly there is no king and no stone, and the prophecy doesn't even say where they are. During the tribulation, the king will probably be dead. Jacob's pillar stone will be lost. We don't know what will happen to it, but it could be destroyed. If no one sits on David's throne, God will have broken his promise." And he writes this, "Imagine someone during the tribulation who has any understanding of God's promise about the throne of David. If he looked around and saw no king and no stone, perhaps the king is dead and he doesn't know where the stone is, or maybe he saw it destroyed, what would he think? He would have to conclude that God's promise was broken, unless he understood what I am explaining to you here. But God is keeping his promise. He explains exactly how in that book. He says, the truth is, by the time this prophecy is fulfilled, the throne in Britain is no longer David's throne. Even before Britain loses its king in stone, the British throne is no longer the throne of David, or God's promise is broken. Hosea's prophecy shows that before the tribulation, God must have a new stone and a new king, a new throne. Otherwise, he could not allow Hosea 3:4 to happen. How else can you explain what is going to happen in Britain? This book all explains all about this new throne, and it is definitely worth reading and studying. God actually moved the throne of David, out of Britain. So that throne on which Queen Elizabeth sits and on which her successor will sit is actually no longer that throne of David, fulfilling the promise God made to David. In this book, Mr. Fleury says, think about this. If Britain no longer has the throne of David, this strongly indicates that Britain is going to go down rapidly. How could it be otherwise? This is a great condemnation by God against that people, and in a sense against America as well. So what will happen when the Queen dies? We can expect that to accelerate Britain's demise as a world power. We really are about to see a very sad ending for that throne, which is no longer David's throne. But I want to encourage you to study the truth about this new throne of David amid all the bad news in this world. This is truly inspiring truth. It shows how God is watching over these events closely, and it also shows just how close we are to the return of Jesus Christ when he comes to claim his rightful place on that throne of David. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Andrew Miller, Josue Michels, and Mihailo Zekic. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Thomas Jefferson. If you want something you've never had, you must be willing to do something you've never done. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.